Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about medical image reconstruction. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 421, recorded February 14th, 2017. Gadgetron. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEngine.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you might want to download right after this show and play with it. I don't know where this one's going to be on that list yet, but I'm sure it'll be there somewhere. Joining me this week, once again, is Jonathan Bennett. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Randall. Good to be here this morning.
Yes, yes, our standard most frequent co-host, I think, in the last 3 months because of your high availability, which is always appreciated. I presume we're speaking to you once again, or you're speaking to us once again. I'm going to eventually get that completely right always, but then it's not going to be as fun. From Oklahoma, yes?
Yes, yes. Corporate headquarters, the home office here in Lawton, Oklahoma, the Flyover State.
Very good. And I am in the same location I was last week, speaking to you once again on my Raspberry, my new Blue Raspberry, portable professional sounding mic. And it wasn't bad on the sound check when I listened to the show from last week. So we're using it again. And hopefully things will work out reasonably well. And now that I know how to build an electronic mute switch so I can cough on this thing, because there's the fit. I'll give you a clue. For people who want to buy these things, the physical mute switch is really, really noisy. So it's not useful at all, unless you're doing a partial show or something. Anyway, enough on that. In Santa Monica on the 11th floor at my longtime client ZipRecruiter, just giving them a shout out for letting me use their office space for this. So this week we have not one, but two co-hosts. No, we have one co-host, two guests. I was going to say the word guest, and I went sideways on that. We have Michael Hansen and David Hansen. There's no relation, actually. This is just a coincidence, apparently. And we're going to be talking to us about Gadgetron, which is a framework for medical image reconstruction. Now, when I had some x-rays done on my arm when I broke it back 8 years ago now, yeah, 8, 9 years ago, they gave me a data file, a disk, that had the data on it. And there happened to be a publicly downloadable viewer that I could use on it. But before it even gets to that stage, it had to go through some software that the doctor owns that takes all the individual pixels and turns them into something that can be read by this other publicly available piece of software. And there's a lot of proprietary programs to do that. And what Gadgetron is, from what I can best understand from looking at their website, is a sort of a public domain pipeline for doing this kind of processing. And, you know, we're dealing with more and more kinds of imaging these days. We're dealing with, not just straight x-rays, but we're dealing with CAT scans and stuff where, you know, thousands and thousands of numbers are being used to generate a two-dimensional slice and even three-dimensional images based on working out the math about, well, if something is in this position in space, then looking at it through this way, that way, and the other way, eventually figure out that it's there. And I hope I'm not destroying what I think this is all about too badly. Jonathan, you want to try to fill in anything there?
So I have worked in some doctor's offices as the IT guy, and one of the things that has always been a pain to work with is their x-ray and imaging equipment, because everything is proprietary, and the guys that own this stuff are like, no, no, you can't have that password. No, no, you can't log into that machine. You can't fix it. You got to have us do it. And it's just a pain. So I'm very excited to see a project where some people are trying to open up some of the code, some of the programs for that style of work. And if it eventually filters down into everyday life, it'll help some people out. So I'm looking forward to learning more about it.
Great, great. Well, this should be an interesting show. I definitely want to talk, for me, mostly the curious thing is the open source aspect of it and the government produced software aspect of it and things like that. But obviously, there's lots of stuff to cover here today. So without further ado, let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Michael Hansen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
And where are you speaking to us from?
So I am speaking to you from the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, in my office.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. And let's also bring on David Hansen. No relation. David, welcome to the show.
I'm speaking to you from Aarhus, Denmark, also my office at the University Hospital.
Okay, very cool. Very cool. Let's start with Michael. Sort of give us the 30,000-foot view. What is Gadgetron and why did it come about and what problem is it solving? That's three questions, but answer them all.
Yeah, maybe I'll start from the last question. So what kind of problem is it that we're working on here? And I think in that context, sure. It's just important to talk a little bit about what is image reconstruction. As I've heard you over the last few weeks plug this particular show on your other shows and sort of your evolution of going through figuring out what image reconstruction is. And it's a lot of people think it's about taking an image that's somehow broken and restore it in some way. And while there is some truth to that, that's actually not necessarily the whole story of what we're talking about here. We're talking about when you get an MRI scan, for instance, or a CT scan, a CAT scan, as you mentioned, those instruments are not cameras. They produce raw data that are various other views of the patient that's inside the scanner. And for that to be turned into an image, it needs to go through a bunch of image processing, signal processing, and it's a fairly complicated process. And that's the type of software we're talking about. And most of the software that does that kind of stuff is proprietary. It is made by the vendors that make the instruments. So your Siemens, Philips, GE, the other big medical device manufacturers, they write this software that turns the raw data into images. But clearly how that software is written has a huge impact on what the images looks like. And also, as scientists, our ability to do research into this type of software relies on us having access to this software. And so because people didn't in general have access to this type of software, we decided to make an open source framework where people can work on complete image reconstruction pipelines, reconstruct their own images and do research and develop new methods and compare these new methods to existing methods and sort of open up that whole pipeline from instrument to actually displaying the image. So that's what the Gadgetron does in just a few sentences.
And so let me understand that then. So what had happened prior to Gadgetron and maybe some other related projects is you basically took your vendor's software for a particular machine and you used it, or, you know, but the smarts for it were all at the vendor, and also you couldn't maybe link it up with other database servers or something. It was all locked into a proprietary solution. So what Gadgetron? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, not only that, as you were saying, you couldn't even take the vendor's reconstruction software and say, go get some data from another scanner and then put it through this reconstruction and see what happens, because even the data formats and the interfaces were completely proprietary and required special research agreements and non-disclosure agreements and so on to work with these systems. So what we did was, there's actually two parts to this. There's the Gadgetron itself, which is a high-performance image reconstruction pipeline that produces the images. But what we've also done is defined a standard, for instance, for how we describe a raw data set that comes out of an MRI system. And then we have made converters that take the raw data from major commercial vendors, Siemens, GE, Philips, and so on, and converts that raw data into what's now an open described format that people can look at this data and then feed it into things like the Gadgetron, or they could reconstruct it in Python or MATLAB or Julia or whatever is their scripting signal processing engine of choice.
So how did this project come about? I presume you started it, and what was your motivation at that point?
Well, this actually started when I lay it out like this. Now we sound very ambitious about the openness, but I have to be honest, that's actually That's actually not how it started out. How it started out was that me and a colleague from the University of Aarhus, also where David is speaking to you from, we had been for a while working on using graphics processors, GPUs, to do image reconstruction. And the motivation for doing this was we wanted to produce the images very quickly. So we implemented a bunch of different algorithms for reconstructing images, but using GPUs. And people got interested in this and wanted the code. And then at some point we said we were sort of happy to share the code, but we were a little bit about embarrassed about the mess that it was. And, you know, we sort of had it lying around in all different sorts of bits. And then we decided, well, we were going to clean it up a little bit, make some toolboxes out of it that people could use. And then we built this Gadgetron pipeline so that people could use the toolboxes for other types of image reconstruction problems that we had. And so that was the form that we ended up releasing it. It was actually for us to have a vehicle for giving away our code in a structured way that was not too messy and that we weren't too embarrassed about. And once we did that, we realized this actually has some real potential for being something that people can use as a reference framework for image reconstruction in general, and to have reference implementations of existing algorithms that can be used for educational purposes or to base new development on.
Very good. David, what's your relationship to the project?
Well, I'm a PhD student of Michael's colleague. He was my supervisor, and he went off to do non-research, what do you call it, business, more profitable ventures. But I stuck in research, and yeah, I've been working with the project since starting my PhD and now doing my postdoc.
Yeah. Now, does that mean you're doing the coding? I never went to university, so I have no idea what being a PhD student actually means. So it's something about you do all the hard work that the professor assigns, right?
Yeah. So Thomas, my supervisor, was a computer science professor. So he did a lot of coding, but I did a lot of I essentially took all of Michael and Thomas's code and ported it from C++ 98 to C++ 11 to sort of modernize everything because some of it had been a little rushed sometimes.
Yep. David is being very kind here. So some of it was quite the mess. And from time to time, David has been the grown-up software developer in our group who has pointed out various inconsistencies and not great designs and so on, and has helped us all be better software developers. I think that's been a very important role he's played. But also, in the context of us being here, I do mostly MRI professionally. That is my particular imaging method of choice. And David has done a lot of CT type of reconstruction. So he also brings a different perspective to it from a different imaging modality. I think, is that fair to say, David?
Yeah, that's completely fair to say. I guess another thing about Gadgetron is that it's, like you say, there are two parts. There's one for streaming data. So everything can happen online, and in theory, you could use all of this framework for anything where you want like real-time data processing. So there's a lot of things I abstracted, so they're offloaded transparently off to the GPU. And then we have a sort of a linear algebra framework to do all the math. And I've been mainly involved in doing the linear algebra.
Yeah, so David's pointing out some important architectural stuff. Like the Gadgetron kind of has two parts to it. There's a set of toolboxes, which are generic toolboxes for doing, we call it image processing, but it's really any kind of signal processing. So there are things like transforms, Fourier transforms, wavelet transforms, other kinds of image processing steps that one may want to do. There's numerical optimizers, linear solvers, conjugate gradient, nonlinear stuff, nonlinear conjugate gradient, so on and so forth, things that you need in order to do numerical optimization. So those are all in the toolboxes, and they can be used in standalone command line applications that people write to do image reconstruction. And then there's a streaming pipeline architecture that goes with it. And this streaming pipeline is essentially, the reason why it's called the Gadgetron is because we think of it, of image processing or image reconstruction, as data passing through a set of modules. And each of these modules are kind of wired together, and we call them gadgets. And when you wire a bunch of gadgets together, you have the Gadgetron. I should give my wife credit for coming up with the name originally. But so there's two parts to it. And the streaming pipeline architecture could really process any type of data. It could be imaging data, or it could be another kind of data that streams in from an instrument. So we also process other types of data that come along with the imaging data, like telemetry about the instrument. It could be physiological signals, like an ECG signal that tells us how the heart is beating and so on. And these types of data can also be processed and either be processed on their own or go into the image reconstruction itself. So there's two pieces to it, if that makes any sense.
Sure. You've mentioned MRI and you've mentioned CT scans. Are there any other scans or images that Gadgetron supports right now? Do you do X-rays or anything like that?
CT is X-ray. If you want to look at it that way, but right now it is mainly CT and MR reconstruction. There has been some little examples here and there done with some microscope images that have been so say you have a microscope image and it's noisy and you want to do denoising of this type of data, those signal processing components would be very similar. So we have people here working at the NIH, for instance, that are interested in taking data that streams out of a microscope in real time, do some kind of real-time processing of them to remove noise and then display them or analyze them in some other form. So real-time processing of imaging data like that could also be used.
Okay. You kind of jumped ahead of me. I was going to ask about real-time processing, so I think you covered that. So the process of what Gadgetron does, I guess mainly with the PT and the CAT scans, how intensive is this? Does someone have to have their GPU set up with OpenCL to be able to do this kind of processing, or can a regular CPU work? Are we talking about supercomputers? Where does this fall in that gradient?
Yeah, so I should say anywhere in that range we have applications. So, but one of the things that motivated us when we developed this framework was real-time processing. So one of the projects here at the NIH that I'm very interested in is using MRI to guide interventional procedures. So basically you have to imagine that there is a physician pushing around a catheter inside a patient and looking at MR images that are being reconstructed and rendered and displayed in real time, and then he uses those images to guide where he positions the catheter, say inside the heart, to measure something inside the heart or to close a hole in the heart or something like that. The reason why we would want to do that with MR as opposed to X-ray is that we can then spare the patient from the X-ray radiation that they would otherwise be exposed to during that procedure. So that's one motivating application. And to do that, we need to take the raw data, reconstruct the image and display it on the screen for the physician in a matter of milliseconds, because otherwise it does not make sense to guide to use the images to guide the interventions. And for those types of applications, we use GPUs. So GPUs play a central role in that, but that's really to speed up the pipeline and have the images displayed with low latency. Then we have other end of the scale, we have other reconstruction problems that may involve very large data sets that, for instance, have been corrupted by motion as they were acquired. And then we would want to include estimates of motion and other stuff into the reconstruction in order to clean this data up and reconstruct images. And that may be a reconstruction that takes minutes. And typically, those are big data sets, so they don't fit very well in the type of memory that we have on a GPU. So we do this on the CPU instead. But then in order to speed this up or make this more have more clinically useful reconstruction time, we actually stream the data into the cloud. So the Gadgetron can be deployed on any computer that you – whatever hardware it is that you want to be able to use, whether it's lots of RAM or it's GPUs or it's something else. But we can deploy it in the cloud. And if you have multiple nodes in the cloud or even locally – but multiple Gadgetrons deployed, these Gadgetrons can communicate with each other, talk to each other, and share the workload so that we, for instance, rather than using one node locally, we can use 20 nodes in the cloud. And that changes a reconstruction from being something that takes half an hour to something that takes a minute or two, which is good enough for clinical reconstruction times. And then the images come back on the scanner. So we basically stream the data in real time into the cloud, get the images reconstructed, they come back on the scanner and get displayed to the physicians in a way that's transparent to the user. And so those represent like the both ends of the scale, something that's very fast local node with GPUs or some remote nodes where you may use lots of them in order to make a reconstruction faster. And we have anywhere in between. So it really depends on what you're trying to do and how long you're willing to wait for your images to get reconstructed. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that's Michael great.
I think Michael is missing a group here because we also have people who are doing reconstructions on their MacBook Air. Like if you don't need 3D images but just doing 2D, it's perfectly feasible to do it on pretty much anything. We haven't tried it on a Raspberry Pi, but there's no reason why it shouldn't work.
Yeah, no, David is right. And in fact, I do lots of reconstructions on my MacBook. Right, if I'm sitting, I'm doing development, I'm playing around with some example data, frequently it will be something that I'm just sitting doing on my laptop and performance is not such a big issue. Lots of these image reconstruction problems can be reconstructed with modest hardware. And in an educational setting, and by educational, I mean PhD students and master's students and people that are working on image processing, in that setting, you know, doing examples on your laptop is perfectly fine. I do that all the time.
So you mentioned that you stream some of this data up to the cloud to be able to take advantage of multiple Gadgetron instances. How does that work with HIPAA? How is that not violating some of the Medical Consumer Protection Act stuff and all of that?
Yeah, no, this is a good question. I always get this question. So, and it is an important one. So, of course, there was great concern about patient privacy when we're streaming patient data up. But there's a really critical thing to know, and that is that the image reconstruction engine does not need to know the name of the patient, the age of the patient, patient gender, or any of these other things that we would consider information that would allow us to identify who the patient is. So when we stream data from live from an MRI system, it is really the MRI system that knows who the patient is. And it's basically just sending it to a dumb reconstruction engine. This reconstruction engine just needs to know basic things like what's the size of the field of view, you know, how many samples have you acquired, and all this basic stuff in order to reconstruct the images. And then it sends the images back to the scanner, and then the scanner will keep track of, oh, it's actually from this patient, get the appropriate headers attached to the images so that when they show up in the patient database, that the correct patient name is on the images and so on. But what goes on the wire does not need to have any patient identifiers on it. So that's one side of it. The other thing is when we stream stuff into the cloud, we always use like an SSH tunnel or some other encrypted way of sending the data just in case somebody would want to grab a hold of it. And on a third level, usually on these cloud instances, nothing is ever stored on the in the cloud. It just takes the raw data, converts it into images, and sends some images back. And it only really ever exists in RAM for a short period of time while these images are being streamed. So there's very little concern about patient privacy when you do this, with a few notable exceptions. So for some neuroimaging applications, if you scan the whole head of the patient, it is actually possible to reconstruct that and get a look at what the face looks like. And, you know, with facial recognition software, somebody could get worried about whether or not you could recognize the patient. But for our application, since I'm at the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, so we scan mostly the heart, and that's not easy to identify. So we've not had a lot of issues with it. But we think about it a lot, and I've had to write a lot of memos to get to do this sort of work. So we try to take care of it and make sure that it's kept as private as possible.
All right, that's great. That really thoroughly answers the question. I think it's fascinating that that's a concern with if you're doing a scan on the head, the reconstruction of the face. I think we really are living in the future. Then we've got a question from the chat room. Virgil wants to know. So it also works with fMRIs, functional magnetic resource imaging.
Yes, well, yeah, to me, it's all just MRI, right? But yeah, absolutely. We have several fMRI groups that use this. If the question is from somebody who's familiar with the fMRI world, the Functional Imaging Laboratory in London, the PHIL, which is one of the big powerhouses in that field, they use the gadgetron all the time. They use it not for the image reconstruction itself, although they do some of that as well, but they also do their whole inline or real-time quality assurance of their data. So basically, as they're doing their real-time fMRI experiment, they display the images in real-time using gadgetron components and use that as their inline QA tool. And that brings up another interesting point. The gadgets, the little components they've implemented to do this are actually implemented in MATLAB. So while the gadgetron framework itself is written in C++, The individual components that sit along the chain of a reconstruction chain can either be implemented in C++ or in Python or in MATLAB, as the case is with what they're doing in London. So there are fMRI people that use this with some existing MATLAB code that they have to do inline QA. So that's a very long answer to your question. But yes, we do fMRI with it.
Oh, that's certainly okay. We like long answers. Gives us time to think about things while you guys are talking. It's been good. We did get another question from the chat room following that theme. MCT asks, how big are the image data sets? And I guess we could expand that to how big are the biggest ones and how small are the smallest ones? As it seems like we cover a lot of territory here.
Yeah, so I mean, it varies several orders of magnitude. I could start by saying it can be as little as you know, some tens of megabytes for the smallest possible data set that would reconstruct one 2D image, that would turn into one 2D image. And it goes all the way up to actually hundreds of gigabytes for the largest data sets. And they typically, those large data sets are acquired over a long period of time. Say we do one of those interventional procedures that I talked about where we're using real-time image guidance. We may be imaging continuously for an hour or more. Or an fMRI study is a good example where for these functional MRI studies, they will scan for long periods of time where they show different things in front of people's eyes or they have people do a task and so on. And while they're doing this, they're continuously acquiring data. And those data sets can run into the hundreds of gigabytes. So it's all ranges in between. And then, but importantly, though, it comes out at a reasonable rate so that, you know, the large data sets take a long time to acquire. So let's say we want to use cloud computing. We can, as long as we keep streaming it continuously while it's being acquired, we can hide that that the data is so big by just keeping the stream going. It's bad if you acquire 10 gigabytes of data, wait until the scan is done, and then you start sending it to your reconstruction engine. Then you've already fallen behind. So there are large data sets, but the large data sets often take a long time to acquire, so we can hide the cost of that by streaming it continuously. That's one side of it. The other thing is it's important to think about two different aspects of the data size. One is the raw data that we turn into images. And then there are the images themselves. Typically, the raw data is about two orders of magnitude larger, so 100 times larger than the actual images. So again, with the cloud stuff, we stream lots of data into the cloud, but we get relatively little data back. So the images are a lot smaller than the actual raw data. So when you go to your doctor, you get an MRI, they give you a little disc afterwards with the images. That's not the raw data. Those are the images. They've already stolen most of the data from you, if you want to look at it that way.
You've mentioned we've talked a little bit about about using GPUs to do some of this processing. Is that built using OpenCL or CUDA? And are there any challenges that you guys have hit along the way trying to work with GPU processing of data? And that might be a question mainly for David. If he's done more work on it, I don't know. You guys let me know.
Yeah. So it's everything is built using CUDA. Mainly because the libraries are more mature. Like there are no libraries to do a decent Fourier transform, and you get that out of the box with CUDA. So unfortunately, it doesn't run on AMD graphics cards. And there have been a ton of difficulties with this. Things like compiler compatibility. If you want to run CUDA on Fedora, for instance, you have to compile your own version of GCC. So that's fun. And we are also we're limited by this needs to run on machines provided by the vendors, and they decide what drivers are installed. We can't change the driver. So that provides some challenges, and it's the main reason why we're using C++ 11 and not C++ 14.
Yeah. So we're constantly kind of making difficult choices about backwards compatibility and what to support. So in the field of medical imaging, the vendors typically by the time they put an instrument on the market, it's being shipped with drivers that are 3-4 years old, and so I like that the Gadgetron can be deployed on the hardware that comes with the scanner, so that people don't have to set up their own box at least to get started. But that means that we constantly have to juggle with old versions of drivers and old libraries and stuff, and that, you know, it's a constant struggle and discussion about when we give up on a given driver version and a given software release. But we're kind of trying to work through that. And on the OpenCL thing, I mean, we've on several occasions taken this look at performance, like looked at critical aspects of our pipeline and seen, well, what if we did with this with OpenCL? What kind of performance would we get? And at every time when we've looked at it, it just has not been as good. And since we're going to the GPU to really push the envelope, to really get the last bit of the performance out, it then seems not quite right to switch to something where we don't quite get the performance that we want. But hopefully it will catch up, and then maybe we will roll up our sleeves and convert it all to OpenCL. But it will be some time, I think, and some work.
So when you guys first talked about what this does, the first thing that came to my mind is reusing some of these old devices in other places where, you know, tech support is very difficult. So I'll just make up a scenario, and you'll tell me how likely it is. So if we've got a CAT scan device that, you know, was used for several years in the United States and then was retired, and some aspiring medical missionary, let's say, takes it to the middle of Africa and says, I want to set this up here, would it then work for them to use Gadgetron to run that because they can't get, you know, the original support for it?
Well, it's a very, very difficult question to answer, actually. But I'll just touch on a few points. So one thing that again, and this is an afterthought. This is not something that was our original motivation that we did when we did this. But something that's become apparent to us is that because we have this generic framework with an open source standard for how we represent, say, an MRI data set, it means that we can go, as long as you can take your data that comes out of your instrument and convert to this format, you can use the Gadgetron. And so it really becomes a question of, if you have this old instrument, this old scanner, whether it's a CT scanner or whatever it might be, but let's say it's an MR scanner, you have an old MRI scanner and you want you want to do the fanciest new reconstruction. Instead of it being now a problem of how do I implement this fancy new reconstruction on some old hardware that the vendor has provided, it becomes a question of can I get a hold of the data stream and convert it? And since we maintain these converters quite a few, I mean, we're at least 10-15 years back in 15 years plus actually back in time on most of these vendor formats, you can take that old scanner, convert your data, and then do the highest performing fancy new reconstruction that's in the Gadgetron. So there is definitely some opportunity to do that, and we actually have examples of people that we collaborate with that have scanners that are now getting up to 10 plus years. But they're running the latest research applications because all they need to do is buy a workstation, put it next to the scanner, and plug it in. And then we have the components that convert the data on the fly. So it definitely opens up for that kind of application. And because we've turned at least part of the pipeline away from being this proprietary silo to something that's open, you have the opportunity to do that. But it takes a little bit of work.
So with the interesting things that you guys are doing, do you have any manufacturers that have actually started looking at supporting you guys officially or generating this universal format that you've created, generating that directly? Do you have any good – so sometimes we open source guys, we're kind of at war with the manufacturers. Do you guys have any good relations with them?
Yeah. I have to – I just have to be careful what I say here. I have – relationship with several vendors and I'll try not to damage any of them. I think over the years we have gone through a lot of stages with the vendors from the typical phases of anger and denial and whatever else that goes on until finally now we're at a stage where there are some vendors that are starting to be very interested and embracing some of these things. And so we do have vendors that in public forums have expressed support for the Gadgetron. The vendor that I work closest with is Siemens, because we have a bunch of Siemens systems, and they now they are actively embracing this idea and supporting it. And I also have been contacted by the other vendors that are interested, for instance, as a first step in providing a way to take the raw data from the scanner and export it in this open format that we have so that people can do research and do reconstruction in frameworks like the Gadgetron. So it is slowly taken up, but it is slow and it has been painful and at times a little adversarial. So we've kind of gone through different phases, but I feel like we're in a good place right now with the vendors. They're slowly coming around.
I would add to that for MRI, it's very good. For CT, it's very, very close. They are not happy that we're touching the data at all. So we're mainly doing cone beam CT because we can get the data. So that's the kind of CT that might be at your dentist if you're going to an expensive dentist, or they're at oncology departments. But for a standard CT scanner, we can't get access. They are just not open at all.
Yeah, and I can say as an example, one of the things we did when we worked on this open raw data format that we use for MRI is that we made converters for the different data formats, and we made these converters available in open source. And when we do that, of course, we are disclosing how the data formats are put together. And that was a bit of a hill to climb because basically I had to sort of demonstrate to the vendors that this could be reverse engineered by somebody with enough time on their hands and some at least some rudimentary computer science skills could get through the process of figuring out how the data was put together if they had access to a scanner. And once I sort of demonstrated that, they sort of came around and said, oh yeah, well, there's really not that much point in keeping it a secret if it's really just a matter of people being aggressive enough in finding out how the format is put together. And so little by little, it's come around. But different imaging applications have totally different views of who has ownership of the raw data. I mean, from my perspective, and maybe I'm a little bit naive and hippie-like, but I think it's the patient's data. I mean, it's their data, so they should have access to it. But the vendors don't look at it that way a lot of the time. They think it's their data format because they came up with it or something. And so we have some difficult discussions sometimes with the vendors where my perspective is that it's the patient's data. Their perspective is that it's their data. And so we go back and forth a bit, and little by little, some of them come around. But David is absolutely right. On the CT side, things have been closed off, and you can say the same for PET imaging. Although PET is a little bit better, but still, it's not great. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Sure, I think it does. You guys dove into it pretty well. Do you have vendors that have done things to you, like intentionally obfuscate their data? Like, haha, you can't get to this. Good luck figuring it out. Has it gotten that bad?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they've done it to specifically get at us. But I'm just thinking of one vendor in particular on the MRI side, and I will not hang their name out here. But when I had to do the figure out how to read their raw data, they basically, what they do is they take the data, and in order to make it smaller, they do a compression. They have a compression algorithm that goes on this data, and it's basically a variant of a variable length integer compression algorithm. But rather than using one that's like well known, they came up with their own variable length integer compression, which is completely obscure, and then they call it encryption, which it's not, of course, but that's the way it's phrased. They say the data is encrypted, but it's really just compressed. But there are binaries. In that case, we found a binary that was released by the vendor for how to read this data, and then you disassemble it and you open it up and look at the assembly code, and then it's not, it takes a little bit of. It takes a little bit of effort, and not by me, by the way. This was some. There was another clever guy working for us at the time who figured this out. But we often find our ways. We find our way through it, but it takes a long time to reverse engineer. And there are definitely things that have been put in just for the purposes of obscuring how the data is stored.
Have you gotten any pushback or? Violations that people are claiming on the DMCA. That's funny. The little voice whispering in my ear here is asking the exact same questions that I am. Do you think that you violated, or have you gotten have you been contacted about DMCA violations? Is that something you've hit?
No, we've not. So far, we've not received any angry letters or anything like that. I should say, in the beginning, I went about this a little bit naively. I would go to some vendor and say, "Hey, we know how to read this data. Would you mind if I put out a description of how to get through this data?" And there's nothing. They don't say no, but they also don't say yes, and it stalls and it goes on for months and months, and you keep asking and asking and asking. And then at some point, you get to a point where you send them an email and say, "I plan on in 30 days, I will put this online unless you have any objections or see any reasons why this would be a problem." And when you sort of force them to take a stand where they would have to say, "No, we will not allow this," and somehow justify that position, then often it goes nowhere, and then you can publish it. So that's typically how we've gone about it. But it's very hard for these companies, and I understand them. It's very hard for them to say, "Yeah, we encourage this," because if they say yes to something like that, they feel like they're taking on a risk of some sort, right? That there's some risk to them. And if they don't see an immediate benefit, that's very hard for them to deal with. So I fully understand it, and we try to do our best. I mean, we're not in the business of making enemies or making people angry at us or anything. We're just basically saying that as scientists and as patients that put our bodies in the scanner and get scanned, we feel like people have a right to be able to read the data that comes out of the system and work on it from a research perspective so that that we can do meaningful research, which I mean, reproducibility in research in general, but in particular in medical imaging is a real big problem. Like if I go online, I read a scientific paper about some guy has developed a new reconstruction algorithm that somehow makes the images look better or can reconstruct with less data or whatever it might be. If I don't have the code for that, I can't compare that to my own method, or I can't improve on that. And so this is a situation that we've been in our field for years and years now, where scientific paper after scientific paper comes out, but nobody can really compare them to each other, right? And I feel as scientists and as patients and as citizens that, you know, pay taxes, that fund the research and so on, I think it's important that the research that comes out of it is open so that we can build on it and make things better and that we can have a meaningful discussion about comparing methods and so on. So that's our perspective. And that's sometimes at odds with the vendors. And then we try to work with them the best that we can. And in general, we've not had any super angry letters or emails. It's mostly been a little bit of anxiety, and we try to help each other through that. So if that's
you would think that the vendors would be very interested in having this project generate better and better and cheaper and more flexible algorithms for essentially doing the coding that they would have to pay people internally to do. You would think that they would embrace this open source community that's doing their work for them.
Yeah, it sounds obvious, doesn't it? but it's a little bit more. And I say I think actually some of them are coming around to seeing that way. Certainly, some of the people that we talk to are coming around to seeing it that way. And I think it absolutely is in their interest to have as many people as possible working on these algorithms and having it done in as meaningful as possible a way, so that you take method A, you compare it to method B, anybody can read the code, we can compare the images, we can see what comes out of it. I think that's in everybody's interest, including the vendors. But I think they get worried that they have all this secret sauce, you know, all this stuff that they have built up inside the companies over years, and they feel like if they start sharing this method, then other vendors will have an easier time getting in. So it's about sort of letting go of your protectionist traditions, and I think this is not just in the medical imaging field. Lots of software companies are going through that now. You know, big software companies, and again, I won't mention any names, that have been very closed off, very closed source over the years, are now more and more embracing the idea of giving their code away and having more and more people working on it. And so I think that's just something our field has to go through as well. But it's not a quick process.
Absolutely. Well, it just sounds like the medical industry is about 10 years behind the e-commerce community and the banking communities and other things that have already figured out that open source, the rising tide of open source raises all boats at the same time. So I want to ask, we're sort of getting out of time here. This has been fascinating. I've had a lot of great and interesting questions in the chat room already and things like that. But I want to ask about the project itself. So you've got a bunch of software. It's on GitHub. You're putting code out there. It's you're making progress with it. How many contributors do you have? Where are they coming to you from?
I would like to say that I have a lot more contributors than I have or than we have. So, but the truth of it is, at any given point in time, it's basically me and David and four or five other guys that are working on something, and then a few people come in and out. You know, they may come for a while, contribute to a little thing, and then they sort of disappear out in the distance again. But it is a very the medical imaging reconstruction field is not huge, right? It's not e-commerce, it's not banking. We're imaging scientists, so it's a small community, and you know, our mailing list has about, you know, 100 members on it, and again, at any given point in time, it's two or three people having an interaction. So I would say that there has been maybe 15 people that have made major contributions to this over time, and at any given point in time, it's, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 people that are actively working on stuff. So we have, and I should mention this if somebody's interested, every Friday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern time. It's a little early for you guys out there on the West Coast, but that's to make it line up with Europe as well. But every Friday morning at 9 a.m., we have a Google Hangout that anybody is willing to join as long as there are seats available. What we do is every Friday morning just before 9 on the discussion board that we have, I post a link to this this Google Hangout. And anybody who's interested in getting involved can just join. They can just sit and listen to some of the conversations that's going on. Usually we discuss some technical problem, how to deal with, you know, are we going to put this feature in? Are we going to put that feature in? How do we get rid of this dependency? What's the problem with this version of the compiler and so on? So things like that we discuss. And then people that come in and just have questions, how do I get this set up? Why does it not work with my compiler and all this stuff? So people are very welcome to join that. But what I wanted to, in answer to your question, is any given week we have, what would you say, David, five people, somewhere between 5 and 10 people that join this call. And so that's kind of the little core community around this, and then people come and go. So it's a small community, but we would very much like more people to get involved.
And what language is this in? It sounds like C++.
So most of it is C++, and some of that C++ is CUDA specific. About 8-9% of the code is CUDA code, and you know, another 80% is C++, and then we have some other languages in there, some scripts and things, some Python stuff. Some gadgets are written in Python. So,
and a little bit of MATLAB.
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, and a little bit of MATLAB.
That's okay, a little bit cool.
Speaking of closed source, that's been an issue. I mean, getting that to work has been so much work.
Ah, that's unfortunate. And your license looked pretty liberal, but it wasn't one of the standard open source recognized licenses. I mean, it's basically a do what you want to with it. I'm presuming that license has been reviewed by some legal staff.
Yeah, basically. I mean, I really wanted to. So, being a government employee, I thought this should just be public domain, right? So that. But there are actually countries in the world that doesn't recognize your right to give up copyright, and so you can get into some issues with liabilities and stuff that I was unaware of. That was what our legal staff advised me anyway. So we chose a license that was as liberal as possible, but we had to point out in that license that that you know the National Institutes of Health, which is a government organization, our name cannot be you know, misused or misrepresented as endorsing some kind of product or any. Let's say somebody took the Gadgetron, built a product based on it, and then say this is somehow endorsed by the NIH. So that was what we were trying to avoid with this or trying to capture with this license. But we wanted to have a license that was liberal enough that if a company wanted to take this project either in the whole or parts of it or whatever and build a product out of it, that they should be welcome to do so without necessarily having to release their code. And that is, again, this thing with the vendors, they would be very cautious about taking code in that would force them to open up everything they have.
Yes.
So we're trying to be accommodating that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I know a lot of people are hardliners with the GPL and say everything that's open source should be GPL. But you've just described the opposite reason for an action argument for a much more liberal license than the GPL provides to not infect the rest of your code with the GPL virus. Rather appropriate given we're talking about medical stuff. But one of the other things I was sort of curious about is this software mostly being used by researchers, or are doctors in seeing public patients using this now for their data analysis that they have to do for their retail clients?
Yeah, this is a good point for me to point out something very important, that this is of course not an approved medical device. As we say, this has not been reviewed by the FDA or approved by the FDA or anything like that. So this is a research tool, formally. That being said, there are lots of medical doctors that do research on patients. And so we have groups around the world that have Gadgetron installations where they scan patients as part of their clinical workload, but lots of these patients consent for their data to be used in research. as part of protocols that are going on at various university hospitals. And those doctors use the Gadgetron in their research. So it's a research tool primarily. And if this was to be an FDA-approved product that somebody could scan a patient and, you know, send a bill to the insurance company, somebody would have to take it, get it through the FDA approval for any application that they want to support with it, and then put it out as a product, which is another reason for this license. We wanted to make sure that if somebody wanted to put in that effort, which is formidable, by the way, the regulatory burden of approving these types of things, if somebody was willing to invest that energy, they should be able to do so without necessarily being bound by a GPL license. So that's kind of been our motivation. But there are medical doctors that use it, but it's a research tool.
Oh, okay. So I won't necessarily, if I go get my arm, scanned at a local hospital, I should knock on wood that I don't need that to happen right now, but it's like it might, this isn't something I would find in their office then, typically.
Not yet, though. Although if you went to a major university hospital in the U.S. Or the U.K. or any of the other sites where we have deployments and, say, got an MRI of your heart, it is not completely unlikely that that physician would be doing a research protocol on the side, with your consent, of course, where your data would go through the Gadgetron. So
that's awesome. And it sounds like, just getting back to the size of your development community, sounds like I was going to ask if you have any Gadgetron conferences yet, but it sounds like you have one of those every Friday, and it's virtual. You don't all get together. Although, if you ever all got together and you wanted to cater lunch, it wouldn't be that expensive, which is really good.
That's a good point.
Yes, you could have a Gadgetron conference and cater the lunch and have it sponsored by one vendor. It'd be really cool.
Yeah, we could do the whole thing for $100. That's cool.
There is some advantage in that. There really is.
Yeah. Awesome. Anyway, we're almost out of time. I know you gave me a lot of questions that I could ask you if I ever got stuck on this, but I think we've been doing pretty well getting through all that. But is there anything we haven't asked that you wanted to make sure our audience is aware of before we have to let you go?
Well, one thing, and you touched on it a little bit, is what if people want to get involved in this, what do we need help with? And I would say we kind of need two different types of multiple different types, but at least two different types of people to get involved in this. And one is just users, so people that are not necessarily interested in getting into the nuts and bolts of doing image reconstruction and writing the actual signal processing code themselves, but that see applications that are in the Gadgetron that could be useful in their research. If they want to reach out to us and say, hey, how can we get set up? How can we run this on our scanner? How can we take our own data and convert it and use it and all that stuff? People like that would very much like to get involved. So people that just use it, tell us when it breaks and all that stuff, that's very useful to us. And then also people that are interested in writing code to support new applications. So a lot of us that have been involved in this from the beginning have been interested in cardiac imaging, so looking at the heart. But there are tons of other things to image, and for each of those applications, that can be application-specific signal processing steps that one may want to take either in the reconstruction or in the post-processing of the images. So people that want to get involved and say, hey, we should make this work for liver imaging, or what if we can take this motion correction that you have over here and make it work for, some other part of the body that they want to image, those people would be really great to get involved. I'd really like to see this turning into like a complete reconstruction engine where most of the stuff that gets done, say, on a clinical MRI system can go through this, get reconstructed, and you can get meaningful images. So from an educational perspective, I really think that would be great to have that as a base. So anybody who wants to roll up their sleeves, please drop us a note or stop by on our Hangouts on Fridays and get involved.
Okay, great.
I would say that,
Sorry.
I mean, if you're a programmer and you don't know the first thing about MRI, but you want to do work in medicine somehow, then we have a lot of things that need to be done and don't require specialist knowledge, or maybe they require specialist knowledge like network engineering, things like that. Then we definitely could use people with that sort of experience.
Yeah, definitely. People that are just really good programmers, low level, high level, whatever it is, that want to get involved and just write some code. We have a lot of mess that needs cleaning up. If anybody's interested.
Well, that's really exciting and thrilling. I'm compelled now. If it's a mess that I have to clean up, I'll get right on that. That sounds great. Well, I have two final questions that I have to ask both of you. So otherwise my audience will yell at me. They literally do. They actually email me and they say, why didn't you ask that guy this question? Anyway, so here we go for both of you. First with Michael. What's your favorite scripting language and what text editor do you use all day?
So I'm happy to report that my favorite text editor is Emacs.
I saw that in the peripheral.
All right.
And right now, scripting language wise, I'd have to say Python. but I will say though, I grew up with Perl. That was the second language I learned, and I am very fond of Perl. But it's just for signal processing. It just does not have the libraries and stuff and visualization that I need for image processing. But so Python and Emacs for me.
Okay, well, 1 out of 2 isn't bad. Although I did see you editing XML with Emacs, which I know Emacs can do everything, but I would have presumed that you had something a little more stronger for doing XML processing.
Yeah, we do. If this was in the tutorial, I was probably just trying to stick to one thing or something. Going through it, but yeah.
Okay, and David, same 2 questions.
So in a perfect world, I would be writing Haskell in Vim. But in the real world, I'm writing Python in PyCharm.
Okay. Haskell count as a scripting language? I guess it does. I guess you can build Haskell scripts that start with shebang Haskell, I guess. Okay. Well, guys, it's been wonderful. This has been an interesting conversation. We're out of time, though, absolutely out of time. So we're going to have to let you go. But thanks for coming on and talking about Gadgetron today.
Yep. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Great. That was Michael and David Hansen, no relation. What did you think there, Jonathan?
I think it's yet another show where we could have gone for another hour. Very easily. Interesting guys to talk to. I look forward to the day when medical imaging devices come with Gadgetron or another open source program like it to be able to do this image reconstruction on the fly, to officially be supported as, you know, approved by the FDA or what have you. I think it's just a matter of time because it sounds like they're doing some really good work. The license they've got makes sense. So I'm convinced it'll happen, whether it's one of the existing players or one of the ones to come. But certainly interesting. Interesting to see yet another bastion of closed source being attacked and brought down by a really good open source project.
Yeah, and it sounds like these guys are on track for that, and I think it's lucky that they were able to take the data formats and reverse engineer them well enough to be able to do anything useful with them at all. It's other than encrypting it, not encoding it, but actually encrypting it. There's not a lot that the vendors can do because it has to end up getting stored on the client's machines and stuff. And, you know, it really is my data. You know, the data that comes out of my body is my data. Boy, you could start a whole big discussion on that. But I think I'm going to stop there with that. And instead, I'm going to move right on. We're out of time. We'll move right on to our upcoming shows, which is next week. We're going to be revisiting from 2009 Arduino. I know that Arduino is a big popular topic. And a lot has happened since 2009 to what happened with Arduino. So we'll have some people representing the project there. Just added to the schedule between last show and this show is SQL Pro, which is a fast, easy-to-use Mac database management application for working with MySQL databases. So the application itself is completely open source. Working with MySQL, of course, is open source, but it's an application that runs on Macs. So I'm probably going to get some hate mail. I already know that. I'm ready for it already. I'm doing this show on a Mac, and I'm using an iPhone. And yeah, I know you guys hate that I do that. They want me to run an Android phone and be on a Linux machine somewhere, but no. I use what works at the end of the day, and now I'm going to get mail on that. Okay, I'm going to shut up now before I really dig myself in a grave here. And following that, we have SIMP, S-I-M-P, all caps, which is a managed ecosystem for secure operations. So as we're talking more about things like HIPAA and PCI compliance and things like that, there's a lot of moving parts, and there's a lot of things to think about in terms of keeping it secure and keeping it, especially with all the problems we're having these days with, well, now we have international problems with is keeping things secure. So these guys took Puppet as an infrastructure, and they've added a lot of layers on top of that, and all open source, of course, which is why they're on this show. Still trying to plug the last few shows of Q1, Q2, I guess, starting on Q2. To try to fill in the schedule for that. I'm sending out a flurry of emails, and I am getting a little frustrated. So, boy, I tell you, now is a good time. If you ever had a project that you wanted to get on Floss Weekly, here's how to do it. You contact the project leader or maybe a community coordinator if they're big enough, and let them know that you listen to Floss Weekly and that you'd like to hear more about their project, your project that you use on this show, and then have them email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. That email address is on the Twit homepage, twit.tv/floss. And also from there, you can see our upcoming list of people that we're already talking to. We do tape this live in front of a studio audience. Well, not really a studio audience, a virtual studio audience. They're all at home or wherever they are. They're in this chat room. 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Tuesdays at live.twit.tv. That's 9:30 a.m. Pacific time, according to the local daylight saving time schedule. We do have a Google Plus page, Floss Weekly. That also tweets over to Floss Weekly, all one word. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus. That's where I source most of my bloggish things. That also tweets over to Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N. I'm going to be at Scale in just a couple weeks, Yapsi, and OSCON. So if you see me at one of those, please come say hi to me. Hopefully I'm also going to be at DragonCon and FizzLay, working on both of those right now. I have nothing else to plug because we're out of time, but Jonathan, you want to plug anything?
Sure. So first off, I'm JP_Bennett over at Twitter, and I've got a trip coming up at the end of the month where I'm going up to the D.C. area to an NDIA conference on FPGA verification, which sounds horribly interesting. I also wanted to mention that I guess I am the open source antidote to Randall here. I'm running Linux Fedora 25 on AMD hardware, and I'm using the open source AMD GPU drivers and all of that good stuff. I use an Android phone. So, ha.
Yes. Well, at least some of us are beholden to the title of the show. Yes, that's very good. And Jonathan, thanks once again for jumping in at the last minute to help me out with this show. Hopefully sure. You won't be the guest next week or the host next week.
Yes, I'll be the guest next week. I'm not sure what I'll be talking about.
I think I'm pretty much done with this show. So we'll see you all again next time on Floss Weekly.